welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the writer of TV, comics, and books, Paul Cornell. Paul, welcome to the show.
Oh, good evening.
Now, this is one of our occasional themed episodes, as it were, because this episode will be published on April 11th, which is shortly before St. George's Day here in England. And that is why we are going to talk about cricket.
Right. Well, I dare say this must have happened to you many times in the past, that your guest goes, well, I don't think that everything you just said applies to the subject I've brought along tonight. As a fellow podcast host, I would guess that that happens to you one time in three, maybe?
Possibly even more, but that's kind of the point of the show, right? Is that you don't think it's maligned, whereas an awful lot of other people do. You know, and in the case of cricket, I mean, it is one of those, we know it's a very popular sport.
I was going to say, enormous global sport, which, you know, it's not really a marginal pursuit.
No, but at the same time, people who don't like it really don't like it and don't get it. And I confess, I am one of those people. I don't get cricket at all. I've never got it. So please explain to me, what is the appeal of cricket to you?
Well, I think that cricket fans, we historically don't really help ourselves in this regard. In that there's quite a subset of the culture around cricket, which is about telling people how complex it is, in inverted commas, and actually using it as a gatekeeper thing to stop people getting in. And actually, it's not a complicated game. It's a really quite simple game that you can pick up by watching in about half an hour, I dare say. You know, if you go into the depths of it, then yeah, of course there are complexities that it might take a while longer to learn. But sometimes you don't have to learn them. For instance, all the names of the various different fielding positions. I'm a huge cricket fan, and I have no idea. I just know what a couple of them are called, because if I ever needed to know what those were called, I could look them up somewhere. It's never been part of my enjoyment of the game. It's never affected my enjoyment of the game. And I think a lot of what people are put off by, it falls into that category. You know, that famous long piece of what once was comedy about, explaining cricket to somebody who doesn't understand it, you know, when the batsman's in, so-and-so's out, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just nonsense designed to alienate people, honestly. From a time when everybody would have known, you know, that's the kind of, it was an in-joke about for a whole nation back then, but these days that's really unhelpful. The appeal, it's two things at once, and I think I get a unique form of relaxation when I really get into a cricket match, especially when I'm watching it live in the stands. But, you know, on television too, and on the radio. There are two things going on at once. Firstly, there's the ebb and flow of mathematics. That is to say, you're aware of records approaching, of a particular batsman having a particular average. Will he do better than he's done before? Does he have a particular weakness against this particular bowler? And those, the little maths problems and equations, and I'm really selling this, there's equations in it. the mathematics of it churns away, but at the same time, beside that is the poetry of it, which is also going at the same rate. That is to say, it's a very demanding game, but what it demands of you is artistry. So, you know, one can both admire Alastair Cook's slow trudge, the ability to score lots and lots of runs when he's playing badly. That is to say, he's barely seeing the ball, but there's a skill in him which manages to stay put and concentrate and not get out, despite the fact that he's absolutely off his game that night. But if a player is on song, like in Ben Stokes's recent enormous double century, which was gotten at an immense scoring rate at high speed, just because his reflexes, his experience, the directions he played the ball were all formed together in a marvellous feat of athleticism that was entirely about skill. And quite often, cricket audience will really appreciate a beautiful shot. That is when the batsman has his eye spectacularly on the ball, catches it at just the right place, and plays a classically shaped shot, even if that shot does not score any runs. There's something about the artistry of it that runs alongside the maths at the same time that's uniquely relaxing. Mm. In that I think it actually runs both sides of the brain at once that way. And when you add to that the culture of the game, the history of the game, the political import of the game, the fact that this is about colonialism, about freedom.
Right, it was spread around the world via the British Empire.
Mm-hmm. And many of the cultures of international cricket are about fighting the British Empire. You know, the West Indies cricket culture is about freedom from slavery. Australian cricket culture is about their first cultural artifact that was theirs and theirs alone, that they were the best in the world at. Various other India's cricket, that it's their game now. They're the biggest cricket nation, they're the biggest audience, and they've got the most money involved in the game. They've basically taken the game of the oppressor and turned it into their game.
Right, reclaimed it almost, yeah.
Well, claimed it.
I claimed it in the first place, yeah.
And so, you know, there are all of these little stories all going along at once. And at its greatest length, a five-day test match, it's called a test match because it is a test. I've played the shortest possible form of cricket, half a day on a Sunday afternoon.
Right.
And you come back from that aching, you're going to be stiff all over the next day. The amount of running a fielder does, or between the wickets a batsman does, or toward the wicket a bowler does, put that continual exertion together with having to throw yourself about in the field to try and catch balls, to throw yourself onto the ground just to stop balls from going over the boundary. It's a very physically punishing game. People don't realize that. And, you know, you put 5 days of that, 5 entire days of that back to back, and it's an immense test of physical endurance, but during which a batsman is going to have to concentrate in an extraordinary way for momentary bursts as the ball comes at him and as he decides in milliseconds which shot to pick. And whether to block, whether to try and get some runs, what's the game situation, where are the fielders? So many things you've got to think about at once while there's a ball coming at you at 100 miles an hour. And, you know, there's just so many things that can happen, so many different factors. Football, soccer is a very simple game, and that's the joy of it, that's the attraction of it. I wouldn't say cricket is complicated, but it is complex.
Right.
That is to say, once you appreciate it, there's lots of layers of things going on. But I think it can equally be enjoyed on a very surface level. I think 2020 cricket, the shortest possible form right now, is a tremendously exciting and interesting game for anybody who might want to watch.
It's, okay, there's an awful lot here to sort of cover, but one of the first things I want to address is, and this is something that I've derided myself in the past, I admit, how can a game, well, firstly, the fact that a game can take 5 days to play is extraordinary, but how can a game that takes 5 days to play sometimes end in a draw? That's befuddling to me.
Those are some of the best. that's when two teams have fought each other to a standstill, and it has to stop somewhere. They did once try to play a timeless test. That is to say, England and I think South Africa back in the 1890s, I think it was, just decided to start playing until there was a winner. And the trouble was, I think it was after 9 days, they had to abandon the game because it was time for the English to sail home. And everybody was just moving so... Everybody was making decisions so slowly and being so defensive and, you know, not risking anything that, you know, it would have taken many, many more days than that. And they were dead, basically. You know, they were dead on their feet.
But I find that extraordinary. There are 11 batsmen go in per innings, if I've got that right. Is that correct?
Yes, and you need 10 of them out to get the side out.
And each team gets the same amount of innings, gets an equal amount of innings. So,
they don't necessarily.
Okay.
In the longest form of the game, right? There are three forms. I didn't intend to teach cricket tonight, but I actually do this at various conventions I go to, so I think I can do it very fast.
Okay.
There's a thing called an over, which is a particular bowler bowling six balls in one direction at one particular wicket. The shortest form of the game, 20-20, is 20 of those units per side. So, say five bowlers will each bowl four overs. And then the other team will have the same number of overs. The one-day form of the game, as it's called, the second form of the game, is 50 of those units.
So that's 50 times 6, yeah?
Yes.
Right.
But when you get to the test, four-day cricket, first-class cricket, that's your county championship, or international test cricket, five-day cricket, it's not about numbers of overs, it's about time. So one team will start batting, and they'll keep batting as long as they can. They'll just stay put until they're out, or they've decided they've got enough. Then the other team will start batting and try and match the total of the first team. Then the first team will come in again, then the second team will come in again. And after that's happened, when that collides with the end of 5 days, you have a result or you don't.
So when you're talking about scoring, you're talking about scoring runs, yes?
Yes.
Right. So I still don't understand how you can do that. And I mean, what are the chances of, after all of that and all those, players and all those overs, what are the chances of them having completely level run scores?
Ah, well, this has happened about three times. That's not a draw. A draw is when 5 days runs out and there's still no result.
How can there be no result?
Because, well, think about it.
Because they didn't finish.
Yeah. If team one scores 300, mm-hmm. teams two scores 300, team one comes back in again and scores 200, that means team two then has to score over 200 in whatever time is left. If they don't get there, but still have batsmen in and ready to play at the end of 5 days, we don't know what the result would have been at the end of 5 days, therefore it's a draw.
Oh, so time literally can just run out while you're in the middle of your go, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're down to your last two batsmen, and it's getting dark, and you're desperately trying to hang on and not lose, then a draw can be very exciting as you wait for the clock to tick away.
Wow. And I would assume that there are penalties for time wasting.
Oh, yes, there are.
Right, because otherwise you could just wander around and not be ready.
Yes. There is a certain amount of that, but the umpires will start yelling at people and, you know, making them move, you know.
Right, right.
There are also fines that can be imposed, you know. But a tie, the thing that's only happened, because draws happen reasonably often.
Well, they do. That's why it's a long-standing joke, yeah. Okay.
But ties. A tie is when both teams get... A tie would be if team two there got exactly to their 100... To how many did I say they needed? They
200.
Needed 200.
Yeah.
They get exactly to 199. They are level with team one, and then they lose their last batsman, and they're all out. And so both sides have put two sides in for the full length. Both sides have got in twice for their full length of time, and they've scored exactly the same number of runs, and time has not run out. That's a tie.
And that's, but as you say, that's only happened three times in history.
In history, in several centuries.
Well, I was going to say, which doesn't really surprise me because, as I said, yeah, the odds of that happening must be extraordinarily low.
Absolutely.
And that's something we should mention, actually, for, let's be honest, the vast majority, although we're doing this in celebration of England and St. George's Day, the vast majority of people listening to this will be American. And mm-hmm. I don't think most Americans realise how old a game cricket is.
Well, yes.
It dates back to the 1500s, I believe.
Well, we don't actually know. We have records...
At least the 1500s, is that the case?
Yes, we have records from Henry VIII's time of something called creag, which might be it, but we don't know where the word cricket comes from. There have been claims for origins in France, Scotland, and China.
China?
Yeah.
Wow.
There's lots of people think cricket is something to do with wicket gates. That is to say, shepherds with crooks standing in front of gates that look a bit like wickets and defending those gates with their shepherd's crooks. That's a sort of pastoral idyll of where it might have all come from.
That sounds a bit backronymish to me.
It does, doesn't it? It sounds a bit too good to be true.
Yeah.
But no, nobody knows.
That's what, because I assume that it has the same word root, the same etymology as croquet. It's another game played with, you know, a wooden bat and a ball and hoops in the ground or sticks in the ground.
You might well assume, but I think we know the roots of the word croquet and we do not know the roots of the word cricket.
Really?
Yeah.
What are the chances of
Well,
that?
Indeed. But no, it became enormous business in the 1700s. I think I'm right here. My history of cricket is not one of my most brilliant subjects.
I think I saw, because I did read up a little bit on this before the show, and I think I saw that it became the national sport during the 1700s. So that would jibe, yeah.
When a lot of money floods into it and a lot of betting is done. And a lot of the county cricket teams that still exist in England date back to around then. So, and records have been kept for literally centuries.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's one of the attractions of playing the game. That, you know, if you play for a county or for your nation or even for some village sides, you will be comparing yourself to records that go back centuries.
That could go back 200-300 years.
Mm. So your achievements are sort of set in stone. You're measured against a huge legacy. So say Brian Lara, who holds the record for the highest individual test score, knows that he was better than centuries of people.
Wow.
That's one of the major attractions of the game. I like all forms of the game. I like the excitement of 2020, which lasts just from tea time to just before the pubs close on a Friday night.
Right.
And has been designed to fit into that by social gap. And I really love the longest form of the game. With the longest form, it's really about exactly the same experiences being either stretched or compacted. How much time there is to think.
Right, well, because that can increase the tension, can't it? And the psychological aspects of any sport.
Well, yes, but in the longest form of the game, if you don't think you can score runs against a particular bowler, you can stand there carefully blocking for those six balls, and it usually you've got the leeway to do that. But at the same time, it's much more fatiguing. You know, you still have to concentrate for those short bursts during all that time. And if a bowler sees that you're just blocking him out, he will feel very much on top. And the captain of the side that's bowling can deduce all sorts of things from that and set all sorts of traps for you. Moving the fielders around, luring the batsman into knocking the ball in a particular direction so they'll be caught out, sledging, the craft of actually using verbal abuse, wit and wordplay to lure the batsman into getting out. That's a time-honored tradition as well.
Well, that's actually a part of the game.
Well, it is a part of the game. It's not within the laws, but then some things aren't. Actual verbal abuse, that is to say, saying things that would be illegal anywhere else, is illegal. It isn't allowed in the game. But coming up with some witty rebuke or saying something to undermine the batsman's confidence, that's absolutely happens all the time and is generally thought to be fair enough.
Wow.
And great bowlers like Fred Truman of Yorkshire would... he was famously when he got someone out and they said to him, "Oh, great ball, Fred!" As they walked past, he just said, "Oh, we're wasted on me." And it's there's the wit of the game is part of the attraction as well. It's also noticeable that it's about class. For a long time, bowlers came from the north,
right?
From working class origins, and batsmen were aristocrats from the south for some reason.
Well, and cricket was regarded as a way of becoming socially mobile in the early 20th century, especially, I believe.
To some degree. I mean, there were two entrances from two dressing rooms at various cricket grounds marked gentlemen and players.
Wow.
Players being people who worked for a living and were paid to play cricket, and gentlemen being independently wealthy sorts who did not take a fee for the match.
Good old British class system.
Absolutely. So, you know, there's all these pressures and tensions. There's everything culture contributes to what happens on the field, because it's about that the construction of personality and character. You can read people's characters in how they play cricket.
Right.
Andrew Flintoff, known as Freddie, became the absolute symbol of British simple good-heartedness, where in not only the way he batted, which was he didn't care if he got out, he would just smash it all over the place, but also... when the Australians lost a test series to us for the first time in years, there's a famous photo of him squatting down and putting a hand on the shoulder of an Australian player who's literally sobbing and saying something like, you'll be back soon, you know, this doesn't last and all that. And actually comforting his opponent right in the middle of the field of play.
That's very sporting of him.
It is. And that's also part of the game, that... the spirit of the game, as it's called. I myself believe in playing to the laws. That the spirit of the game is fair enough if you're talking about stuff that's outside of the area of the laws like that.
Right.
But for instance, people talk a lot about walking. That is to say, if a batsman knows he's out, but nobody else is quite sure, the umpires can't decide... all the modern technology that's there hasn't helped. There is a school of thought which says if you have felt that merest brush of the ball against your bat as it went by, but nobody's said you're out, you should declare yourself out and walk off. I think it's up to the umpires, honestly.
Interesting.
Having played the game, sometimes you simply have no idea. There are times when I would honestly say I don't know if I hit that or not, because it's all over in a split second.
Right.
A lot of this is about the reaction time of the human body and how that informs personality and character as well. It's said that the best players, and they filmed some, hitting sixes, hitting huge blows, which send the ball over the rope that marks the boundary, a home run in baseball parlance. Often they do it literally with their eyes closed. They've just reacted. They've used their body has used their experience, their training, their autonomic nervous system to make them move reflexively in a particular way that will score the maximum possible runs.
Well, that's similar to what you talked about earlier with a player's B game or C game. You know, if they're not up to it, but they can still grind away and keep scoring somehow.
Yeah.
I'm seeing a lot of parallels here with a sport that I do love that is also kind of maligned, which is snooker. And snooker has a lot of the same aspects of the most exciting games are the ones that are really short or the ones like the World Final that are really long.
Right.
And yes, there's in snooker, they often refer to it as stickability or as grinding, where a player, yeah, clearly isn't having a great day. They're clearly not on form, but they can still somehow stick in there and grind out a win, even just relying on their B and C game. And that's the same. The reason that came to mind is because that is the same sort of instinct, you know, but the player is clearly just relying on their natural instinct and years and years and years of practice to get them through the game rather than the sort of flair that you get when Ronnie O'Sullivan scores a maximum within, like, I think it was 6.5 minutes or something ridiculous, which is, you know, tremendously exciting, but obviously, you know, it's rare as hen's teeth.
Oh, absolutely. I should also say something about the bowlers. The art of either fast bowling, sending it down very fast and accurately, or even better, spin bowling, where you actually send it down, relatively speaking, more slowly, although, again, people are often shocked by how fast even a slow bowler, the ball is moving. But with a spin bowler, it's about what happens when the ball hits the ground and then heads upwards towards the batsman. A spin bowler can put magic into the ball to make it change direction in chaotic and wonderful ways when it hits the ground.
I assume that's similar to the sort of spin that a baseball pitcher puts on the ball. But again, baseball is not a sport that I'm into either, so...
Well, there's some similarities, except a baseball player, of course, it's the air.
Right, it doesn't actually touch the ground first.
Right, that's the big difference. So the cricket, an awful lot is about what happens when the ball hits the ground.
And I'm sure I remember reading somewhere, don't they use the same ball all match?
No. The ball is changed after a certain number of overs anyway.
Oh, okay.
And the old ball is good for spinners, the new ball is good for fast bowlers. So generally speaking, you save up your fast bowlers until a new ball comes along.
Oh, I see. Right, right.
And then the batsmen will, you know, have to go into their shells a bit and hunker down and stop scoring so freely because they've got, once more, hard things coming at them at 100 miles an hour.
Well, and that leads us nicely into... the one thing that I know about cricket, and that most people over here anyway know about cricket, even if we're not fans, is mainly because there have been endless TV dramas and movies and stuff about it, which is the body line controversy. Can you explain exactly what that is? Because I've never quite got a handle on it.
A England cricket captain, Douglas Jardine, who was of a particularly ruthless nature, touring Australia when the Australians had held the Ashes, the prize for the Australia versus England contest.
Which takes place every year, I believe. Is that right?
No, it's every 3 or 4.
Oh, is that all? Oh. Mm.
And it's hosted in turn between England and Australia. Sometimes we go there, sometimes they come here. And it's a 5-test match series. So that's basically 25 days of play of five individual contests, and it's incredibly hard fought. It's immensely important for both sides, but Jardine, the Australians had held the trophy for a very long time, and Jardine decided that he was going to do this by all means necessary. So he got a bunch of working class northern bowlers who bowled the ball very fast, people like Harold Larwood, and told them that instead of aiming the ball to lure the batsman into a shot that might get him caught, or aiming the ball at his feet to try and get him off his reflexes and knock the wicket over and get him out like that, that they were to deliberately bowl so the bouncing ball would come at them in their necks, their chests, their heads, in order to scare them into playing wild strokes, which would get them out. And it was the obvious development. There's nothing in the laws to stop you doing it, and somebody was going to do it one day.
Right.
And at the time, they didn't wear any helmets, any kind of protection at all.
So you have a dirty, great wooden leather ball coming at you at 90 kilometres an hour.
Yes. And people have been killed.
And, oh, really?
Yes. Goodness, quite a few over time.
Wow.
Quite recently, actually, a Australian player who was very beloved and a member of the test team and still in his youth, in a state game, got caught in the throat by a bouncer and died. And the bowler, of course, was distraught.
Mm.
And that was an enormous thing. And that was only, what, 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh, wow.
But modern helmets and protection help a lot. But anyway, during the body line, a number of batsmen were very badly injured. England reclaimed the Ashes, but at a terrible diplomatic cost. The Australian Parliament actually sent a complaint to the British Parliament. And,
really, the government's got involved.
They threatened to break off diplomatic relations.
Wow.
And it was always said that Jardine was willing to play by these rules. The Australians tried to do the same back at him, and he composed a very big score, but was standing there and bravely taking it. But rules came in swiftly to limit the number of balls and over you could do like that.
Oh, I see.
So a bowler can put in one, but if the batsman dodges that, they'll know that they don't have to worry about another one for 4 or 5 balls.
Right, I see.
And also these days with protection, you know, if it catches you in the chest or in the groin even, although that still happens and is regarded as very funny by everybody on the field.
Of course, yeah. But it's not as intimidating as it once was.
No, because you're covered in plastic and armour, basically.
Well, it's like the another sport that I do love is American football, the NFL. And, you know, I know a lot of English people, because obviously we play rugby over here, take the mick out of NFL players and American football and say that they're all pansies because they're all wearing this armour and why can't they play like real men, like rugby players? But what most Brits don't realise is that American football players did used to die of things like broken necks before they all started wearing, you know, massive gladiatorial suits of armour. So this stuff really is necessary.
Yes. And
I'm sure it's the same in cricket as well, yeah.
Oh, very much so. I mean, you know, There weren't a lot of raised voices when this stuff started to come in, saying, you know, this is a betrayal of the game. Actually, everybody kind of accepted that this was necessary.
Oh, that is interesting, considering how much of the game is tied up in tradition and, as you said, like, you know, British upper class, which is historically, famously resistant to change.
Well, I'm sure there were such voices, but it very swiftly got accepted.
Right.
And you know, it's. I think everybody who's played the game realizes that this could happen to you. I've taken a ball straight on the nose, and it's really difficult to face the next ball after that.
Oh, I'll bet. I'll bet.
You know, you get really shy of it, but it's really important to do so because you'll never walk back otherwise.
Right, you got to get back on the horse. Yeah, yeah. To coin a phrase. Okay, so you mentioned the Ashes, and the Ashes, yeah, is this ongoing series between England and Australia. That's one thing that, again, sort of confuses me a little, because there's no cricket equivalent of like a World Cup. I mean, we have leagues.
Oh, there is.
Domestic, but you don't, it's not like people travel around the world playing 5-day games against, you know, every other country.
Yes, they do.
Really?
Yes.
Wouldn't that take a year to play?
Oh, it takes more than a year.
Oh.
The there's a rolling test championship at the end of which a prize is now offered. The current champions are, I think, Australia, but that was several years ago because it takes 4 years for the whole cycle to complete.
Oh my goodness.
It's not immensely satisfactory because of various political reasons. Not everybody is playing each other right now. And but people did have that thought. In the shorter forms of the game, there's very much a one day and a 2020 World Cup. And that's absolutely like the Soccer World Cup.
Oh, so that is a proper event where everything's in one place and, you know, yeah. Short matches and stuff.
Absolutely. This is being played in India and it'll take 3 weeks.
Right. Oh, okay. But the test matches, the longer matches, that's what takes 3-4 years.
Yes.
To get around. Mm. Wow.
there are league tables. You know, we know where we are in the league table internationally in all three different forms of cricket.
Right. This is, funnily enough, actually another parallel with snooker, where for years, people complained that the game took, or a lot of people complained that the game took too long. And so in recent years, there have been things like a shot clock added to certain tournaments. And there are tournaments that reduce the number of balls and limit the amount of time that a match can take. And, you know, much like you were saying about tests, actually, we'll just, after a certain amount of time has passed, we'll just say, right, that's the end of the frame. And whoever's got the most points wins, rather than necessarily playing to its end. So, yeah, you know, I think that's an inevitable thing with modernization of these older games, when frankly people had a lot more free time back then, or so it seems anyway.
Oh yes. It's also, I'm not quite sure why I say the 1950s stadiums for cricket matches were full when there's no cameras down there to put the action on big screens. So you basically have to squint at a tiny figure in the distance doing a tiny thing.
Maybe everybody had opera glasses.
Maybe so.
Mind you, people used to do that with, well, they still do that with soccer as well. And I know a soccer pitch obviously is smaller than a cricket field, but nevertheless, you know, having been to a few soccer games, it's still pretty, if you're up in the gods, Lord help you, you know.
But at least you can see when the ball's got in the back of the net.
I suppose that's true. you can't see when the bail's come off the wicket.
Oh, yes, exactly. Often the only way to see that it's the reaction of the players.
Right.
One of the things I really love about cricket is being part of a crowd during a big emotional day.
You did say you've been to live matches. So tell me, what's that like? Because it seems like a very... I mean, you know, famously, Richie Beno and commentators like that used to joke about, you know, he's sitting there in the commentary box eating cake because it was so laid back and so everything felt so slow.
They still do on Test Match Special. They mentioned their cakes because there are gaps in the action. People watch in England, I think around the world, people watch Test cricket by popping in. They will, you know, if I'm in London and there's a test match on, I will look in a pub to see up on the screen what's going on, and I'll register what the score is, and then I'll go on my way. Or I'll have it on in the background while I'm working, because you don't have to spend, you don't have to concentrate on every moment. I'm actually so used to the sounds of cricket that I can look up when anything exciting's happened based on what the sound's been.
Right.
But no, if you're there for, say, a day of test cricket, there's this tremendous feeling of audience involvement. And the big screens really help, but it's the ebb and flow of emotions during the game. It's... you know, if your side are batting and it looks for a long time like the opposition are going to bowl them out very cheaply because they've lost a few or because they're sitting there and just not being able to score, and then gradually they start to move faster and they start to score faster and milestones go past, and then I watched Joe Root, an exciting current England player, score a double century at Lord's once, and that took all day.
Wait, he was batting all day?
Oh, yes, this is not unusual.
Wow. Presumably with a break for lunch.
Oh, with a break for lunch and a break for tea.
Right, oh, for tea, of course.
So that's from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. with, I think it's an hour and 45 minutes off.
Wow. So that's a proper full day's work.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's immensely physically draining. And he scored 200 runs during that time. And just listening to the crowd, feeling the group emotion of urging him on, and cheering him when he got past every milestone. And, you know, it's an immense feeling of being part of something, something beautiful. And because, of course, he gets more and more fluid and artistic as his eye gets in. And so, you know, the ball will suddenly, there'll be a clonk, and the ball will suddenly appear flying up into the air in front of you. And I've had balls land right beside me. And there's nothing like that sensation of here comes the game right to me.
Presumably you threw it back.
I never got hold of it. It was always grabbed by somebody nearby.
Well, I mentioned that because in American sports like the NFL and baseball, if the ball goes into the crowd, quite often they just leave it there. You know, somebody in the crowd's got it and takes it home.
No, but the condition of the ball is important in cricket, so that the actual ball has to be gotten back onto the field if it's at all possible. Also, I've followed Somerset for a season through their campaign in a one-day contest. And the Somerset fans with their cider and their songs, and the way that the songs can both support and celebrate and hold up a side, it's largely the Wurzels, a comedy British folk band for the Somerset fans. Singing songs about combine harvesters and blackbirds and cider.
Wow.
And that was wonderful fellow feeling from the West Country. One of the lovely things about following county cricket is that if you go to a match at one of the smaller grounds, you'll often find, and this is true actually of some of the international grounds as well, you'll often find yourself just a few feet from one of your heroes who's standing just there, and actually has to stand just there if they don't move the field around very often for quite a long time. And so you get, if the crowd is, has a running joke about that player, you know, they will do a bit of banter with the crowd. They will, at the times when they're able to drop their concentration, they'll be able to turn and talk to you, sign autographs.
In the middle of the game.
Well, yeah, because, you know, there is every six balls, the bowler bowlers change and the ends change. That is to say, a bowler will bowl the next six balls from the other end facing the other wicket.
Oh, right.
So there's, at the very least, everybody has to jog around. And, you know, there'll be times when the captain's deciding where to set the field and where the water is sent out every hour or so. So, you know, everybody has a drink of water. And stuff like that allows a lot of interaction with the players on the field. And I remember a crowd getting the England fast bowler Simon Jones to wear a comedy wig. And they tried to get him to do it all day, this wig that had somehow landed at the edge of the pitch and was just sitting there beside him. And then in the last 5 minutes, where it became clear that nothing further would be decided, and he put it on to huge applause around us. And I remember an Aussie at an outground, I can't remember the name of the player, but he had an enormous Batman tattoo, and I was shouting at him, "That's Bob Apparow, a Batman art on your art," and we started having a conversation about comics but Jim Apparow, as the comics fans in your audience will undoubtedly correct me on. I don't think any comics fans are now here still. I think we've lost them all the way back.
But I think you might be surprised. okay, so that leads us into a nice segue into the last thing I wanted to ask you, which is, why does cricket appeal to the English so much? Why is it such an English game?
I don't know. I don't know if it is an English game anymore.
Well, I know you said it, the indies have kind of, you know, they've taken it and it's become their game. They play it more. They spend more money.
Also, we are vanilla. I mean, every other nation in the world defines itself in its cricket because of its opposition to us.
Well, that's kind of what I mean, though. You mentioned cricket and people still think England.
Yeah.
And not even, they don't think Great Britain. They specifically think England. Why is that?
I think that it appeals to certain images of national character, which I'm not tremendously into, honestly. I mean, the fact that you can get a hard-fought draw feels a bit like Dunkirk to us, or, you know, a bridge too far. It feels like, you know, that's to some, in some tiny corner of the English psyche, that's the most we can hope for, to just get by.
To just draw level.
Yeah, and I dislike that tremendously. I'd like us to want to win a lot, as the Victorians liked to win lots. And I don't empathise with it, with British negativity. I really, really dislike it. In fact, I enjoy Australian cricket culture in that respect, that sense of can-do. The almost samurai ethos that somebody like Steve Waugh as captain brought to the game. There's always a tremendous sense of honour in Australian cricket, right alongside a tremendous willingness to shout foul abuse at the opposition. And these two things are held in balance. I don't know why the English invented so many games that need sunshine. Why would we do that?
That's true, yes.
But
a sport that can be absolutely ruined by any kind of inclement weather.
Yes. And I think it's a game about endurance appeals to the British. Mm. That it's
that more stickability, about, yeah.
But I do think that the fight between cricket and soccer is actually about bits of British culture.
Class, yeah.
Yeah, except cricket includes the class struggle within itself too.
It is still regarded generally as a game for posh people over here, though, compared to soccer.
But try and say that in Yorkshire, you know.
Well, unless you're in Yorkshire. Yeah. Speaking as somebody who lives with a Yorkshire woman, yeah, I would never try and say that.
Some of the northern leagues have such competitive village cricket that you'll get an international foreign player brought over, a still active international foreign player, brought over for a large sum of money to play village cricket.
Wow.
Because the leagues are that competitive.
Paid for by the Rotary Club or something.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, with a very professional organisation of that village cricket team. And who are playing for large prize money. You know, it's that sort of setup.
Oh, is village cricket even actually played for prize money?
In the north, and where there are big active leagues, yes,
right,
and probably for down south for trophies and stuff like that. There's a semi pro setup that extends right down into the roots. Anyway,
see, okay, so just try and sum up for us then why, especially our American friends, who would probably have to go online to follow it. In any case, why should people try cricket out?
I think because it's an exciting and interesting game that can be grasped pretty quickly, but then has lots and lots of depth to it. You know, it keeps going all the way down, which I don't think you can say of soccer.
No, that's probably true. There's not many sports you can say that of, actually.
I think if you like baseball, then the cultural values of the game are very similar to cricket. That there's it occupies a similar place in the British heart as baseball does in the American one.
Well, and with good reason, because cricket is literally the father of baseball. It was apparently a former cricketer who sort of codified a lot of the stuff around baseball, the rules and the stats and what have you, that are now so important to people who follow baseball. I mean, like I say, I'm not one of those people, but I have enough friends who are very, very into it to know that that's important to them.
the first recorded international cricket match was between America and Canada.
Really?
Really.
Wow. And on that note, Paul, thank you very much for coming on the show and celebrating England and cricket and telling us all why it is unjustly maligned. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, they can find me at my website, paulcornell.com, or follow my own podcast, The Cornell Collective.
And are you on Twitter?
I am. I am at Paul_Cornell, because Paul _Cornell got the name first and has tweeted precisely once.
Oh, don't you hate it when that happens?
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned, and please remember to check out my comics, books, and music. Go to anthonyjohnston.com for information and links to all of my work. You can support the show by rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes, and if you really like it, please leave a review. It's the best way to spread the word to new listeners. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.